And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Harry Freeman, and today my guest is D.J. Donaldson. Don has written 5 medical thrillers and 8 forensic mysteries, including his newest novel, Assassination at Bayou Sauvage, which is published by Astor and Blue LLC in New York. D.J. Donaldson earned a Ph.D. in human anatomy at Tulane, spent his career at the UT Health Science Center in Memphis. Well, Don, welcome to Book Talk.
Thank you for having me.
One of the reviewers for Bad Karma in The Big Easy, one of your earlier books, said about your two main characters, Andy Broussard and Kit Franklin, "Andy and Kit are a match made in mystery heaven." For those who aren't familiar with your characters, might you give us a quick summary of who they are and what they do?
Yeah, Andy Broussard is the hugely overweight New Orleans medical examiner, and where most people are self-conscious about their weight, Andy just doesn't care. He loves good food. He loves to both cook and eat good food. He loves antiques, old master oil paintings, which he collects. And almost all of these paintings have sheep in them. And you'd say, well, why would he want pictures of sheep? Well, it's because those pastoral scenes are so calming compared to a life that every day deals with the most horrible things one human can do to another. And he has 6 1957 T-Birds. He doesn't just collect them and look at them, but he drives one each day, a different one each day. They all have original paint. They're not restored. They're all original condition. And you would think that a man that large, how could he even get into a car that small? And even when you see him do it and get out, it's like a great magic act. You don't understand how he just did that.
What do you like about New Orleans as a setting for your mysteries?
When I first started to write, I wasn't sure if I could even do it, and I thought I needed a big canvas to work with. I needed help from the locale. And where else would you set a mystery except New Orleans if you've ever lived there? I mean, the setting itself is such an evocative place. You've got the French Quarter. You've got the surroundings, the bayous. I love the bayous, that whole feel of those big old live oaks with the limbs that drape down and almost touch the ground like some compliant pachyderm. The whole place just seemed to me the perfect place to write about.
Well, as you just mentioned, Andy Broussard seems to epitomize New Orleans, even down to his weight, from enjoying probably too much etouffee and too many oyster po'boys. What other ways do you see Andy reflecting New Orleans aside from his eating habits?
In Bad Karma, the book before this one, the city was destroyed by Hurricane Katrina, and the pain that he felt from the destruction of that is evident, I think, all through that book. It's not just the destruction of certain parts of the city. It's everything. As he says, I think, in one part of that book, it's the Bywater, it's the 9th District, it's the French Quarter, it's everything. It's the gumbo that's been simmering for hundreds of years, and he's just really worried that it'll never be the same again.
You ever eaten a lucky dog?
No, I haven't.
Well, that's kind of the ultimate test, I think, of the true New Orleanian.
When I was there, I didn't know that Paul Prudhomme, the famous chef that had a restaurant right there in French Quarter, mm-hmm. would occasionally leave his restaurant and go have a lucky dog. Had I known that, I would have thought nothing of it.
From personal experience, I share the lucky dogs taste best early in the morning after you've had a few too many beers. Otherwise, it might be a little problematic.
You know, there's a great book that was written about the history of the lucky dog franchise, and it was sent to me for a review, and the review is in some historical publication. But it was a great story because, as you can imagine, that is one crazy operation.
Yeah, well, we all remember Confederacy of Dunces when Ignatius was in the hot dog business.
Well, he points out in that book that one guy had to be fired because he was warming his socks in the bun warmer.
Ah, the stories in New Orleans. Well, you're obviously familiar with New Orleans' fine foods other than lucky dogs. What dishes might you recommend to our listeners before we get into the plot of the book?
Crawfish etouffee, for sure. One of my favorite places to go is the Court of Two Sisters, because you've got that beautiful courtyard, and there's a huge, I think it's a wisteria that's out there, just covers the whole thing, and there's just an ambience there that you just can't beat. So almost anything that you could get at the Court of Two Sisters.
Boy, nobody could ever accuse you of waiting too long to have something happen in the plot. Talk about beginning with a bang. Andy Broussard is at a picnic conversing with his Uncle Joe. Picnic doesn't go as planned.
So let me just set that opening scene for the listeners. As you say, Andy Broussard is sitting at a picnic table across from his Uncle Joe, and they're in Bayou Sauvage. This is a national wildlife refuge on the outskirts of the city. The occasion is a picnic celebrating Joe's 80th birthday. Suddenly, Joe's head explodes. Hearing a gunshot, Broussard looks to the right. There, out in the swamp, 200 yards across the water, is a boat. In it stands a lone figure with a rifle. The nearby park rangers scramble for their boat and soon are speeding toward the killer. Before they reach him, he drops his rifle, produces a pistol, shoots himself in the head, and drops dead into the water. Several hours later, after Broussard has had a chance to examine the killer's body in the morgue, he begins to believe that most of what he saw after Joe was shot never really happened.
We're going to leave the details of the plot up to the listener. There won't be any spoilers here, but we'll give them a preview that your take on what actually happened was impressive and creative. It is definitely a plot twist. As Andy pursues what really happened, he calls his little Cajun friend, Bubba Ustelet, who we know is from Dea, because he speaks the language with a lot of D's and Do's and Dets. Can you tell us a bit more about this Bubba?
Yeah, Bubba is comic relief. He's uneducated, but he's not dumb. And sometimes he provides that comic relief intentionally and sometimes unintentionally. And I think humor is important in a book like this because there's so many horrible scenes in it that you've got to have lightness somewhere. And so Bubba is one of the ways I get that. We were talking before we went on air about where Bubba's name came from, and I was actually in New Orleans, and a car went by, and the license plate, it said that car was bought from Bubba Ustelet Used Cars. And I thought, Bubba Ustelet, I love that name. I love the rhythm of it, the sound of it. And so I just appropriated it. And I've never told that story before, and I'm almost sorry I told it just now, because he may be listening, and you never know when somebody that's in your book will come back to surprise you. One of my earlier books, I was doing some research for it, riding around the outskirts of Louisiana, some of the small towns, and I stopped at some little gas station, and I bought a Cajun Zydeco tape, and on that tape was a piece by a musician named Blackie Forestier. I'd never heard of him before, and I'm not sure many people outside of Louisiana have. And so in that book, Kit Franklin has gone off the road, and she's in a swamp, and her car is sinking. And somebody comes down the road, and had he not been listening to Blackie Forestier singing and singing along with him, he might have seen the car tracks that would have caused him to stop and rescue Kit. But he didn't see it because of that Blackie Forestier tape. Well, I was doing a signing in New Orleans several months after the book came out, and a woman came up and said, Blackie Forestier is my neighbor. She says, and he is so excited to know that he is in your book. That was amazing, I thought.
And then there's Grandma O, who is nothing if not colorful and plays a significant role as the plot unfolds. Tell us more about Grandma O.
Well, Grandma O, it's Grandma Ustelet. Everybody calls her Grandma O, although she's grandmother only to Bubba. She runs a restaurant where Broussard eats at least one meal a day. And she's a huge woman with a powerful personality such that if you order anything in her restaurant and you don't eat every bit of it, you have to explain why to her, and she's probably not going to be smiling. There's an ongoing kind of joke that every once in a while, Broussard is always trying to steal some of her recipes, sometimes by looking through the window of the kitchen while she's cooking, and she always manages to thwart him. And there's one conversation I remember in one book where she said, you want my recipe for egg Ustelet? There's only one way you can get it. He said, what's that? He said, we could be getting married.
And his cohort, Kit Franklin, gets deputized to follow up on what appears to be a completely unrelated crime. About that, we will say no more, other than she goes to Gator Willie's. Now, I know you use a lot of real places, but I wasn't familiar with Gator Willie's. Did you make that one up?
I did make that one up.
Well, the thing I was most impressed about was the mechanical alligator. Do they really have mechanical alligators?
I have no idea. It was just a play on the mechanical bull,
I've
obviously.
I've seen those mechanical bulls, and they're scary enough, but you overlay that with an alligator, and, well, you might be on to something new there. And then you have to tell us in this interview about Kit's main squeeze, Teddy LaBiche, another one of those great Louisiana names. What business is Teddy in?
Teddy's an alligator farmer, and When I wrote one of the early books, I actually visited an alligator farm, and I had to throw the boots out that I actually wore on that trip because it's been so long ago now, they've cracked and aren't usable anymore. So it's been quite a long while ago. But if you're going to write about an alligator farm, you have to visit one. And so in the books where I describe Teddy's Alligator Farm, that was a real place that I visited. So where does Teddy's name come from? It's Teddy LaBiche, and there's two ways you can spell LaBiche, L-A capital B-I-C-H-E, or L-A small b. And as I understand it, if you're a large B LaBiche, you come from an aristocratic ancestry, and if you're a small B LaBiche, you don't.
They mentioned at one point Guy Fawkes masks.
You see them everywhere. There's some group, and I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's this face of a smiling Frenchman with a mustache, and he's got a big grin on his face. And I just have been seeing it everywhere. And so it just occurred to me that this might make a nice touch to put into this book. That's where it came from.
One of your characters is De Leon, who was kind of a fringe character in there, but I thought he was really an interesting person as the plot unfolded.
Just De Leon.
De Leon.
So before you start writing one of these books, you have to know where you're going. I don't outline, but I have to know a few things. Mm-hmm. I have to know who did it and why before you ever start. Otherwise, you can't create the red herrings and scatter them through. So you have to know who did it, because that tells you something about who he is and who would be around him and what kind of attendant characters you need to surround him with to kind of hide him. So I'm not going to tell you whether Just Leon was a red herring or the real guy, because you have to read it to figure it out for yourself. So he came about as someone who needed to populate the story and could be a distinct possibility as the killer. Where did the name come from? Not sure. I was once in Bayou Tetch, Louisiana, and when I left, I took the phone book with me. And I still have it, and it's full of Cajun names. And so a lot of my names come from that phone book that I took many years ago.
Your books, and this one included, have a lot of forensic analysis involved. Now, you clearly have impeccable credentials to write about forensics. What led you to this rather unique approach to writing mysteries?
I think it was a movie I saw years and years ago about a medical examiner, and I can't even remember the title. I think Lee J. Cobb, he might have been the actor. I just vaguely remember that he, when he smoked his cigarette, the ashes would dribble down on the front of his shirt. And so maybe that stuck with me. But I also knew when I wrote the first book, this was the early days of forensic stuff. And I think my first book came out just about the time Patricia Cornwell's first book came out. Mm-hmm. So forensics was not the widely known subject that it is now. You didn't have CSI, you didn't have all these television shows. And so I was fascinated by the forensics myself and loved learning about it. Now, I was an anatomist, but I was not a forensic pathologist. So I had to learn about the forensics myself. So I could go over to the forensic center because my colleagues over there ran the forensic center. And in particular, Jim Bell was the medical examiner at the time. And he was an avid reader, and he particularly liked Louis L'Amour novels. So he helped me with a lot of the forensics. I would attend autopsies. We would talk about the case, and he would tell me about cases he had in the past. And in knowing Jim Bell, I think a lot of Broussard is Jim Bell, because Broussard loves Louis L'Amour novels. And when Jim Bell died, he died before the first book ever came out. He helped me with the research, but never got to see a word of the book. He fell into a diabetic coma and died, which is shocking for an MD to let that happen to him. So it was a horrible thing. Never got to see the book. But a lot of Jim Bell lives on as Broussard. Jim liked antiques, loved fine food, and the respect that Broussard has for the dead in his care is Jim Bell also, because I remember once that Jim was at the morgue late one night. They store the bodies on these stainless steel slide-out drawers in a big wall on one side of the morgue. And he was pulling out one of those drawers, and it came off its track and tipped to the side and dumped the body. And to keep the body from hitting the floor, Jim just dove over. And he's a big man. He dove over and grabbed it and wrenched his back, and he was out of work for 2 weeks. Because he didn't want the body to hit the floor. And you would say, what difference does it make? It made a difference to him. Mm-hmm. because he has respect for the people that he is working for. It's his job. The last thing he can do, or anybody can do for them, is to solve the murder of who killed them. And along the way, you can respect them still as though they were alive. And that's Jim Bell, and that's Andy Broussard.
It sounds like that scene about the body rolling off the tray may be a scene in a future book.
I hadn't thought about that, but no. Maybe.
So how did you pick up so much street savvy around the crime scenes? I was impressed not so much by the forensics and the examiners. You had the cops talking to each other out there looking at the body, and did you have any help or research?
There used to be a homicide detective in Memphis. I won't mention his name because he was great. I'd go on a ride along with him, and he would role play, and he would be he'd be examining, talking to a perp. So he'd be the cop and he'd be the other guy, and we'd go back and forth. He'd be great. I could just ride around and listen to him talk. And he was also an encyclopedia of procedure. And so he was a great contact. But then something happened, and I've always thought that maybe somebody told him to stop talking to writers because all of a sudden he was unreachable. Could not find him anymore. Could not reach him in any way. And then a few years later, I made another contact in homicide, and he agreed to let me go on a ride along and take me to an actual crime scene. So I got a call 4 a.m. in the morning. He said, okay, we got one. You want to go? I said, absolutely. So he said, okay, go ahead, shower, shave, whatever you need to do. He says, there's no hurry. The body's not going anywhere. Kind of surprising that he would say that. So we get there. It's a rooming house. Place is crawling with detectives, and there's a body on the floor, stuck to the floor in his own blood with a big knife right next to the body. So we look around. I hear a little bit about who's been questioned and what they said. And at one point, I'm standing, straddling the body, holding a paper bag while they empty the victim's effects into the bag. And then the detective I'm with says, what do you think happened? Place is full of detectives. He's asking the mystery writer, what happened? So I remember the woman who ran the boarding house saying that she heard a noise and came out of her room. And there were no lights on, so she crossed the room, turned the lights on the far side of the room, and boom, there's Mr. Smith lying dead on the floor. And I said, look where her room is. How did she get to the lights without stumbling over the body? Detectives look at you and say, hey, that's a good point. Yeah, let's ask her that. And so they ended up taking her in for questioning, and I was proud that I was able to contribute something that at least made some sense and got their attention. But it turned out that it was a suicide because they found a notebook full of ramblings that this guy had written over the years. He was on record as having once tried to commit suicide with a comb, by cutting his throat with a comb. Well, that didn't work so well, but this time he got a big knife and it did work.
In one of your death scenes, maggots play a role. Might you tell our listeners the important role of maggots in determining time of death?
Probably a lot of people know that now because of CSI, and it irritates me that CSI is out there, the various iterations of CSI, they're plumbing the depths trying to find all the good stuff to write about, and so it's hard for me to find stuff. But that's pretty interesting because time of death is one of the most difficult things that a medical examiner has to determine. My detective friend, that sometimes you get there and the killer's still kicking the body, then it's easy. Yeah. But most of the time, that's not the case. And so you have to figure out, when did this happen? And if there's been a lapse of a day or two or three, blowflies will lay their eggs on a cadaver within an hour of death. They somehow can sense. There's a smell that develops, and they're very sensitive to it, and they will lay their eggs on the body. And you can tell often by the stage of development of the larvae how long the body's been there. So that's the usefulness of maggots.
Well, you also mentioned the coppery smell of blood. I wasn't aware that blood smelled coppery. Are there other forensic details that those of us who aren't poking around crime scenes might not know?
Well, I always want to explore some particular forensic issue. And in this book, I wanted to explore the issue of what are the characteristics of a gunshot wound to the temple that occurs with the gun actually touching the skin as compared to what it looks like if the gun is 2 inches away, because that often can tell you a lot about what happened. And so that's one of the things I write about in the early part of this book. I explore in detail the differences. And One of the things I try to accomplish in writing these books is I want to teach you something along the way. But you have to be careful because people don't really want to be taught something. If they catch you teaching them anything, they won't like it. So you have to teach them something in a way where they don't realize they're learning something.
You clearly know New Orleans. Was it your time at Tulane that set the hook for New Orleans?
Absolutely. But at the time I was there, I was stressed by graduate school, and I shouldn't probably say this, but I didn't particularly like New Orleans when I was there because of all the stresses. We had no money, the stress of trying to learn gross anatomy, which is a horrible subject to try to learn, almost impossible, the amount of stuff you have to memorize. And it went in a summer course really fast. So I was just stressed most of the time I was there. You have to produce a dissertation. What am I going to write about? My research isn't going particularly well. And so I was in no mood to really enjoy myself regardless of where I was. It was years later when I decided I wanted to write a novel that I knew immediately it's got to be New Orleans.
Can you give us a preview of Coming Attractions? What's on the board now?
All I can say is it's like the sounds of the swamp at night. I know something's out there, but I don't know what it is yet.
Oh, swamps lend themselves well to scenes like that. And then you'd mentioned earlier on that Kit and Andy and Teddy were going to be evolving in their relationships. Is there something we need to know here?
Boy, I wish I knew ahead of time, because this is one of the challenges. In every book, the main characters have to be different at the end than they were at the beginning. Screenwriters know this. I'm sure every film that was ever made, the main character is different at the end. That's the character arc that you hear about so many times. And I would think all novelists would know about it, but I'm not so sure they do. Now, if you're writing a one-off, which is a book in which there's not going to be a sequel, the character arc can be huge. But if you're writing a series, you can't do huge character arcs because they have to be the same character at the end, but they have to have learned something and changed in some way, maybe subtle, but still significant. So that's one of the things I have to figure out, too, before I ever start writing. What character issues are we going to explore here? There's a lot of stuff that has to be lined up and ready to go before you actually start writing. So character arc for both Kit and Andy is important. And in this one, the character arc is about family. Before I wrote this book, this is about Broussard's extended family. So I have at home actual family tree that I wrote out. It occupies actually a couple of pieces of paper stuck together because I took it from Uncle Joe and his wife down through as many lines as I could think of, because I needed to have a lot of people populating this book because I need a lot of suspects. So I gave them names, who's married to whom, so I know where everybody fits. A character in the book is Betty Bergeron. This is the girl who disappears, and Kit is assigned the job of finding out where she is. Well, so I've got Betty Bergeron on my great big map of the extended family, Broussard. And so family is a big issue in this book. And what Broussard discovers when he goes to the picnic celebrating Joe's birthday is, God, who are these people? I don't even know most of these people. And most of them are family. He thinks they're just friends of Joe, but they're not. Mm-hmm. They're part of his family. And so he begins to think during the course of this book, Joe took care of me when my parents died. Even though he had enough children of his own to worry about, he took me on fishing trips and picnics. And why have I not kept up with Joe and the people that I grew up with? Is there something wrong with me? Am I too satisfied with my life, which revolves around my work, my paintings, my T-birds? Have I ceased to care for people? So he begins to feel guilty about not keeping up with the people who did so much for him when he was a kid growing up. So his character arc involves that issue.
Who is June? You dedicated to
June
by
everything. My wife, yeah.
That was nice. I'm one of those people that read dedications and always wonder who they are. You mentioned the participation of a Dr. Francisco, a retired medical examiner, for his help with the book.
I've known Jerry for years, and probably when Jim Bell was helping me write the first book, I'm not sure, but I think Francisco was probably the chief medical examiner, and Jim Bell might have been an assistant examiner, because Jerry Francisco was the examiner for years and years and years. And Jerry Francisco has been very helpful, but he's kind of an aloof personality, and you're never quite sure. I was never quite sure, are we friends, or just acquaintances? Is he just tolerating me, asking questions? Mm-hmm. And then one day he just really surprised me. I was going to give a talk at the World Mystery Conference, and I thought, I want to give a talk that I want to call Andy Broussard's Forensic Casebook, and I want to talk about real forensic cases and show people what's involved with forensics. And how am I going to do that? I'm not a medical examiner. Where am I going to get the material? So I went to Jerry Francisco and told him I wanted to do this, and I couldn't believe it. He pointed to his slide cabinet where he had all of his 2x2 Kodachromes. Back then, this was before PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. So all of his cases were there, and he said, any picture you see there that you find interesting, I'll tell you about the case. So I got to just go through his years and years of cases, and anything that looked interesting, I would take the slides, and then he would tell me the case that went with it. And so I filled most of my talk with pictures, Kodachromes, from his collection. And then, to top it all off, there are two forensic anthropologists at the Forensic Center when I was doing this, and anthropologists have the best stories for some reason. Well, one of them was an expert on saw marks left when killers dismember their victims. And he had just come back from a consultation on the Paul Bernardo case in Canada. Paul Bernardo was a guy that, along with his girlfriend, would kidnap young women, murder them, and then dismember them. So he was telling the authorities what kind of saw they were looking for. Well, he had just come back from this case, and he had pictures. The thing that set this case in motion to where they realized that they were getting somewhere was that Paul Bernardo encased his latest victim, dismembered her, encased her torso in concrete, and threw it in a local reservoir. Well, this fisherman went out, got up on the bridge, and he's casting around. Well, the decomposition gases from the torso broke the concrete, and the torso floated free, and it was floating on the reservoir, and this fisherman accidentally hooked it. And so I have pictures from the Bernardo case of the concrete, the torso, the fisherman still on the bridge. That poor guy had to stay there for hours after the police came. And still, I don't know why they made him hold on to his fishing pole, and he was still hooked to the torso. So I've got pictures of this poor fisherman on the bridge. And so I got to show in my talk the first public pictures of the Paul Bernardo case that had never previously been seen. And so I don't think people at that talk realized what they were seeing, that they were seeing things that no one else had ever seen before.
Well, our listeners like to know what writers read. What's on your bedside table?
Oh, I'm just reading Einstein's Dreams. It's an older book written by a Memphian, Alan Lightman, who's a physicist. And it's just a series of essays about, suppose there's a world where time stands still, and then he writes about what that would be like. Or suppose here's a place where time runs backwards. And it's just a series of little essays about different situations in which time behaves differently than it does in our world. Very interesting.
Well, Don, thanks for sitting down with us here at Book Talk. We appreciate it. D.J. Donaldson, Assassination at Bayou Sauvage, which is published by Astor and Blue LLC, New York. Thank you, Don.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.